and actually issue the principle of the calendar for all time. And that's why we have this very day, 19-year cycles in the Jewish calendar, which come from Hillel HaShem, from Hillel the Second. And this is the calendar which we have in effect. And the only reason it works is because Hillel who was, the Second, who was, had real Tmicha, put it into effect way back when. Now, it's a very interesting dispute between the Rambam and Ramban, Maimonides and Nachmanides. Nachmanides of the opinion that Hillel HaShani, Hillel II, prospectively set all numerals, all Rosh Chodashim, in place for all time, and the halacha that a Beis Din has to say, a Mekor has to say, Mekudesh Mekudesh, the new moon is sanctified, a new month begins, he did it prospectively for all time, for all generations, until the Mashiach comes. That's the Ramban's opinion.
What's unnecessary from here on out.
Right. The Rambam, however, has a fascinating opinion. The Rambam holds that really you still need a Beis Din in our day and age. You would need a Beis Din in our day and age to make the pronouncement. So we don't have a Beis Din in our day and age. So we say that, as the Rambam says, what's a Beis Din? A Beis Din is no more, he says, than the representative body of the Jewish nation. The Jewish nation is defined as Jews living in the land of Israel. Anybody who lives outside the land of Israel does not count. So therefore, the Rambam says, the Rambam says that there must always be a Jewish community in the land of Israel in order for the calendar to function. And as long as the Jewish community, they don't actually have to do a thing. Rather, they can rely on Hillel HaShani, they give that tacit consent to Hillel the Second's calendar, and it automatically continues. But he says, it was possible to conceive of any time in Jewish history when there would not be at least 10 Jews in the land of Israel, the entire calendar would fall apart. It would not be possible to make a calendar. And of course, the calendar falls apart, basically Judaism falls apart. So he says, the Rambam says, kind of a mythical passage of the Rambam almost, he says that it will never happen, there will not be at least 10 Jews in the land of Israel in order that the calendar should continue to exist. And again, as long as there's those 10 Jews there, so therefore the calendar continues to exist on the basis of the tacit consent to what Hillel the Second did. So according to the Rambam, Nachmanides, you don't need any tacit consent. It just works on its own, right? According to the Rambam, however, you need the tacit consent of the inhabitants of the land of Israel in order for that to continue to work through the generations. Okay? So that's as far as the calendar. That's really the only thing which is essential for us to have in our day and age. The rest of the authorities of the courts back then, while they're nice to have, punitive damages, corporal punishments, capital punishments, you know, we can live without them. Then the question now where we come, so what is smicha in our day and age? What does it mean, smicha in our day and age? Now, in our day and age, there are three levels of what's called smicha. And we're going to talk about conservative and reform smicha as well, even though it's only in the...
Do they use that word?
What? I'm going to tell you. I will tell you.
Are we starting with Orthodox, or...?
We'll start with Orthodox. There are two levels of smicha in Orthodoxy. There is Yore Yoreh and Yodin Yodin. Yore Yoreh is Y-O-R-E-H, Y-O-R-E-H, and Yodin Yodin is Y-A-D-I-N, Y-A-D-I-N. Yore Yoreh is officially given to people who have proven their prowess in issuing halakhic rulings, meaning that they have been tested on a very small, usually on a very small section of Jewish law, and they've been found to be reasonably, well, they found not to be morons, basically. And since they found not to be morons, so therefore we assume that they'll actually rule accordingly. There used to be a joke, one of the people used to give, I don't think it's a joke, actually, it's serious. There used to be, they say, one of the people used to give smicha to American rabbis, a large American rabbis, was Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. And when you got your smicha, on the back of your smicha, was the phone number of Rabbi Feinstein. Basically, in case of emergency, call here. Don't try and do this on your own, basically. But, know where to call. So that's also part of knowing how to rule is knowing who to call to get a ruling if you have no clue. Yodin officially, although it's become meaningless in the past, 40 or 50 years, but Yodin officially gives the person who possesses that smicha the right to sit in judgment on a Jewish court. Jewish courts nowadays and age sit in judgment on three basic issues. On marriage, two basic issues, sorry. On divorce and allied class issues, and on monetary claims which involve principal, not punitive damages. In other words, where somebody claims he's been robbed or you know, or what's the word? Not rob, not even rob, but misled. I'm looking for a better word.
Cheated.
Okay, good. Cheated. So then, but only on the principle, not on. There's no punitive damages. So the other officially confers on a person the right to judge those cases. In our day and age, it doesn't have that meaning anymore. For the most part, it just means that you somebody decided that you should get a higher form of smicha. Not just your yara, but you deserve to have yod and yodin. When I was in Baltimore, they used to give yod and yodin. I don't have yod and yodin. When I was in Baltimore, though, they used to give yod and yodin for somebody who had finished off, go through Talmud Bavli. Which case, I should have yod and yodin twice over by now. But in any event, I don't have it. But
what's it do for you? What's a rabbi?
It looks good on your resume.
How do you get it?
Yeah. What?
How do you get it?
Yeah. So everybody has different standards. That's the point. In other words, somebody you have to actually learn the laws of choshen mishpat, monetary issues and divorce issues in order to get it. In other places, you just have to learn a little bit more than you learn otherwise. Okay. In Israel, it is serious. In Israel, there are many different levels of smicha given. One is the lowest level of smicha is to be the rabbi of the neighborhood. And that is an officially recognized by the state of Israel, that smicha, and that you have to know more than a regular rabbi knows in order to be a rabbi of the neighborhood. And then there's smicha to be the rabbi of the city, which you even have to know even more. And then there is the smicha to be a dayan, which is it's actually called their kosher, authority to be a dayan. And that's the big thing, because in Israel it's for real. The courts have power, they have teeth, the rabbinical courts, and you really have, it's like a 10-year course of study in order to get that. In America, there's no equivalent to that.
They get a test?
They get tested, yes.
How about the little guys in the neighborhood? They get a test?
They get tested. I took one of those tests, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't take all the tests. I was in the classic case of Israeli bureaucracy. In order to get basic smicha, I learned the basic minimum, which is three parts of Yoredeah. And I got tested by private rabbis and by a chief rabbi of Jerusalem. So I got my Yoredeah. Then I went to the Heichal Shlomo, to the chief rabbi, in order to try and get the neighborhood rabbi's smicha, which is more extensive. So I took the first test on the same material which I had studied for Yoredeah, and I passed it, you know, with flying colors. But then I came to Chutz Laaretz, and I wrote them a letter saying, well, can I please take the test in Chutz Laaretz so I can finish the course of study? So they wrote me back a letter about 6 months later which said, no, we can't let you take the test in Chutz Laaretz since there's no precedent for it. So I didn't bother writing back, well, how are you going to build precedents if you don't have a first case? So at that point, I just didn't, you know, well, who cares? But yes, our tests, which are taken for this purpose.
Do the Haredi rabbis take those tests?
Usually, if they're Haredi rabbis who want to serve in the state system, which are advisable now, they do. But if they want to serve in their own system, then they don't have to do it. But there are very few jobs in the Haredi system. There's far more jobs in the government system.
Do the Haredis respect the rules of the government system?
If they work for it.
What if they don't work?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. There are effective divorces, you know, granted by the regular system, you know. For the matters, when push comes to shove, they'll accept their rulings. They might not like going to those courts, but they'll accept their rulings, you know, because people sitting in courts, as I said, people sitting in judgment, even on the government courts, are usually, you know, recognized to be legitimate authorities by everybody.
What about the American-based, you know, those Rebbein in the cities, are they yod and yodin?
Usually, sometimes one of them does, and the other two are just tag-alongs. That's generally the way it works. In other words, in Chicago, for example, where I lived for a while, so the head of the court, Rabbi Gedaliah Schwartz, has Yadin, I imagine, and he used to take two rabbis to sit with him wherever was available, you know, at any given time. Which is okay. In other words, you're not supposed to be judged by yourself, so you should have two rabbis with you who are, even if they're of lower standards. What happened one in America in the 1950s, when yeshiva started producing teachers to go out, it's really more later in the 60s, I think, when it issued. So it used to be, they started producing teachers to go out and teach in day schools. Now, it used to be acceptable for a teacher, even in my youth, it was acceptable for a teacher in a Jewish day school to be called Mr. Smith or Mr. Goldberg, right? it is no longer acceptable to have a teacher in a day school who goes by Mr. Not acceptable. They have to be called Rabbi. So how are you going to call them Rabbi? So they came up with this wonderful new idea, which is a level of ordination called Rav Umani, which basically is a piece of paper which says that this individual is worthy of being called a rabbi and a leader in Israel. There are no criteria for this piece of paper.
Can I have one?
What? Yes, you can have one if you want. There are no criteria for this piece of paper. Anybody can actually issue this piece of paper for whatever they want. I guess officially you have to have to be called a rabbi yourself in order to issue it, but maybe not even that. And this is issued very frequently, and most rabbis who you meet will do not really, unless they're public rabbis, most rabbis who are teachers in schools do not have Yoreh. They only have this piece of paper, if at all, which says that they can be called Rav Umani.
Is it recognized by the United States as a real rabbi?
You can do marriages if you get one of these certificates.
Mm-hmm.
And I can get one of these certificates by dint of the fact that I've studied here for 9 months.
You could try.
I see a way to make some money.
Wait, but who would give it? Like, how, if I wanted to get one, how?
Well, for the right price, I'm available.
I just become a teacher somewhere, and then
no. Many yeshivas give it. Many yeshivas give it to people who've been in yeshiva for long. You know, they've been in yeshiva for a while. They've learned, so when they leave, if they need to get a job, they give them this piece of paper that says that they're suitable to be Rav Umani.
Now, it would be wrong for me with this new piece of paper to go out and marry Jewish people to each other because I don't have high enough.
No. Marry people, you don't have to have real smicha. Even if nobody has to have there is a halacha. There is, it's brought down halacha that it's proper to have a rabbi officiate at your wedding. Because that gives it, the proper level of decorum and the reasonable certainty that the halacha is being fulfilled properly. But in theory, the rabbi at a wedding is meaningless.
True.
Who really counts the witnesses, right?
But still, for me it wouldn't be much of a kosher wedding to have me there.
Why not?
Because you need a bigger guy. But let's
you need
say,
that in here.
Let's say the Unitarians, you got a Unitarian couple who would like to have a rabbi.
They're most likely Jewish.
Well, if they're not Jewish, I wouldn't be violating anything by officiating at a Unitarian wedding, would I?
I don't think so.
If they're both
Jewish,
Right, if they're both Gentiles.
I don't think you'd be violating anything.
I don't think you could legally call it a real wedding.
But Mara's dying.
But you close up reference on, so, and do it, yeah, sure. Moving down the line in terms of the other movements, if we can call them that, the conservative smicha from JPS is only Rav Umani. They don't give anybody Yoreh Yoreh. It's very rare that there's a rabbi in a certain movement who actually gets Yoreh Yoreh. This actually is a vestige of the days when there were real Talmidei Chachamim in the Jewish Theological Seminary, and they felt embarrassed to consider giving their students true smicha. So therefore, they just gave their students a piece of paper who said that this fellow can be a rabbi and a leader in Israel.
Do they know this? Like, do they understand the hierarchy? Do they know that none of them are getting the real...
They are aware that there is a higher form of smicha which some conservative rabbis get from other conservative rabbis called Yoreh Yoreh. But they don't actually, the overwhelming majority of them have no aspiration to get it. What do they need it for? To serve in their synagogues, they don't need that Yoreh Yoreh. Yoreh Yoreh primarily tells you that if you have some milk which falls into your pot of children, when you can consider nullified and when it's not. What do they care, basically? Their congregants are not coming to ask them their questions.
But I thought they don't care about that at all anyway, so what's the...
Right, so therefore their rabbin is just, when they call themselves rabbi, it's just around, to be a spiritual leader and conduct services. However, by contrast, in the Reform movement, when the Reform rabbi gets smicha, he gets Yoreh Yoreh Yadin Yadin. That's the document that they get. It says that it comes both Hebrew and English, and they go the full shebang. So the I guess the HUC was founded many years ago at the Hebrew Union College back in the 1800s, and by Isaac Meyer Weiss and his cohort, and they figured it out.
That's a non-judgmental approach.
What?
Cohort, non-judgmental.
Non-judgmental. I am being judgmental.
I'm
They actually gave your other. What's interesting is that the law is, of course, that the marriage, that we can't legislate in our day and age. Also, another thing we can't do is abrogate marriages. There are several cases in the Talmud where marriages are abrogated, meaning that they are annulled. What happens is, under certain circumstances, the rabbis say, you know, this marriage should be annulled because of X, Y, Z reason. The rabbis only did that under rare circumstances. The circumstance primarily in which they did it after was a case where there was a divorce issued, which there was a get. For some reason, the get really should not be good on a technicality. The rabbi said, you know what, we'll consider it as if the get is good by annulling the marriage. How the rabbis annul the marriage? Very cool thing, actually. The rabbis say is, the ring you gave to your bride, when you said, Hareat Nekudeshet Li, the Tabaz Du, you are married to me with this ring, Kedat Moshe Yisrael, according to the religion of Moses in Israel, what you're basically doing is saying, Rabbi, my marriage is being done conditionally on your consent. Moses in Israel means code name for rabbi. So therefore, if the rabbis say, well, we decide that we don't like your marriage, so therefore we can come and say, you know what, that ring you gave on our condition, we don't agree to it anymore, and they can do that many years later and annul the marriage retroactively. Again, they did it very rarely, and usually only in a case where there was an actual divorce, which was not legitimate according to for some technicality, so they came in and said, you know what, instead of being a divorce, we'll just annul the marriage to begin with.
Well, but given that there's so much trouble with gets in some small number of cases, tremendous trouble, why isn't that done more frequently?
It's not that, because we've shown it, the medieval commentators say that we no longer have the power to annul marriages. Mm-hmm. You know, it's only specifically the sages who had the real knicha, or say they're, you know, people of that era, the sages of that era who had the capacity to annul marriages or set up the principles to annul marriages. We no longer have that possibility of annulling marriage. So therefore, since that is the case, so therefore we no longer have the power to annul marriages, despite the fact that it would be very convenient for us to do so, in order to, you know, get around many problems with divorce. However, well, now looking at other movements, quote unquote, in a judgmental way. In Reform Judaism, since halacha doesn't really exist as a system, it really doesn't matter, it's irrelevant. But the conservatives still try and pretend that they have halacha, and therefore they just, you know, they have a problem. When are they going to know how they're going to annul a marriage? So what they have decided is that the smicha which they give, even though it's only money, or empowers their sitting courts in the Jewish Theological Seminary to have the same status as a Sanhedrin.
Oh.
And therefore, that if they consider that to be sufficient authority to annul marriages. So in a pinch, if they have a problem, they can't find a husband or not with the spouses or something like that, the Beis Din at the Jewish Theological Seminary will annul the marriages of the people concerned. Okay? So that actually is a power which we no longer have, but, you know, they have decided that they do. Yeah?
What about the power of conservative kashrut certification? Let's say you walk into the Second Avenue Deli, you see the certification on the wall from a conservative rabbi. Is that sandwich trade?
No, it might be kosher.
Might be kosher.
It's not automatically trade. It could, yeah, in theory, it's possible. You know, it's unlikely, but it's possible it's kosher. It actually was a big issue in New York State, because New York State had a kosher law for many years, which said that kosher is only as determined by Orthodox rabbis. And New York State was sued on the basis of separation of, you know, church and state, and New York State law. And the kosher law lost its teeth. And since then, I don't think they've been able to craft a law which will allow the Orthodox consumer to have any protection from, you know, people who
are kosher saying, law?
What?
Well, the kosher law meant that if you stated that your thing was kosher, it had to be from an Orthodox source.
Right.
That's very cool.
Well, it no longer exists. I mean, it was legislated way back when. We're talking about, I think, 1920.
Can't Bush bring that back? He doesn't mind so much.
So the So the kosher law actually, I think, no longer exists as a result of this issue of conservative kashrus. I mean, there was some deli, and Ben Deli in Great Neck, which said, which was found to be a violation.
Was it?
Their branches all over Long Island. So they're found to be in violation of the kosher law. And the owner of the deli said, I certify the kashrus here. This is kosher. I say so.
He has no interest.
And he went to court, right? And he won.
Did the kosher law ensure that the store was closed on Shabbos too, or not?
No. It only ensured that the food inside was kosher. The meat products came from sources of which legitimate slaughter. That's really what it's all about.
So Bishop Ockham and all that wasn't
going necessarily enough. It wasn't as a year, but like the days of kosher law, if you had a supermarket which had in its kosher section a non-kosher turkey, by mistake, they could be fined for that. Now the fine was not so great. It was about, $75 or something like that. So it wasn't going to put a major dent in the Pathmark's business. But nevertheless, you know, there was such a law. They used to go make sure that kosher and non-kosher sections in supermarkets were separate. They're no longer existing.
So you said JCS based in holds for themselves the rights of the Sanhedrin for divorces. Do they hold rights as far as the rest of the Sanhedrin?
Well, there's nothing else. They don't want to do anything else. I mean, the rest of the Sanhedrin would require more restrictive halachic standards.
Yeah,
it doesn't work that way.
They don't claim that.
No, in theory they can claim it too, but they're never interested in being more restrictive. They're always interested in being more permissive, so therefore it's a moot point.
Was that the same body that said that it was mutter to drive on Shabbos if it's the shul?
That is actually the law committee of the Rabbinical Assembly, which is an allied body, but not the same body. It's not the court.
Do they claim to have the power to do this?
What? Well, actually, once you bring it up, the decision to drive out, to allow driving on Shabbos is a fascinating one. I've read the protocols. And it's pretty neat. Basically, the assumption is like this. The assumption is that the only thing which is forbidden on Shabbos is to light fire, right? And I'll light a fire on Shabbos. Well, an internal combustion engine is not a fire. Why?
Explosion.
What?
Explosion.
No, because it didn't exist at the time that Moshe Rabbeinu came down from outside and said, don't burn fire. So therefore, it's not included in the category of fire.
What about the 39
Halachas?
It's only one of them.
You're also carrying the car.
Not carrying the car.
But I mean, lighting the fire is only one of the Halachas, right?
But that's the Halacha you do when you push the gas pedal, you know, or turn the ignition on. Then you're making a combustion, right? So they held that internal combustion is not actually a form of fire. No, that's
okay.
It's preposterous, of course, but they took themselves seriously and they actually said that. Actually printed in Proceedings of the Rabbinical Assembly from, I forget which year, 56, 57, one of those years in the 50s.
Do most
conservatives? What's RCA?
Orthodox. It's the Rabbinical Council of America.
And where are they on the Orthodox spectrum?
More modern Orthodox.
Okay.
Do conservatives, like, does the average conservative Joe Steen say, like, look at the rulings of this body that you were talking about and says, okay, I can drive, but I have to make sure not to carry, and like, are they careful in that? Like, do they actually follow the rulings of their own body, or?
Generally speaking, the whole difference, there is no difference between the conservative and the, with rare exceptions. There are rare exceptions, but generally speaking, the only difference between a conservative and reform Jew is who their rabbi is, not in their level of observance. For the most part, there's very little difference nowadays.
There's a big difference in the synagogue services.
Yes, okay, but that too is also a function of the synagogue, the rabbis are different. There is, interestingly, there was a code of Jewish law put out in the 50s, no, maybe 60s. There was a rabbi in Buffalo, his name was Isaac Klein. Isaac Klein was an Orthodox rabbi from Hungary who came to the States, became a conservative rabbi. And he decided to put out the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, concise code of Jewish law, for conservative Judaism. And, it's pretty close to Orthodox Judaism, but, you know, they allow sturgeon, you don't allow sturgeon, stuff like that, so there are various different issues, but that book is obsolete. You won't find it on the average conservative Jew's bookshelf. As a matter of fact, Now, if you ask most conservative Jews, 99 out of 100 have no clue what you're talking about, because it's a system which has fallen into disuse. Because again, the whole difference is the difference between the rabbis. Certain rabbis are somewhat more observant than Reform rabbis, but the laity, for the back extent, is identical. Yeah.
Oh. No, just wait a minute.
Okay. So I want to come back now to the Orthodox rabbinate. Okay? Now, since we know the Orthodox rabbinate is, very often, the rabbinate is meaningless, as we've just proven, right? You can get a piece of paper, put yourself rabbi. Some people can call themselves rabbi without a piece of paper. So the question is, that happens all the time. So the question is, you know, if you have one white beard, then you look like a rabbi, so people call you rabbi. So the question is, how do we know who has authority to issue decisions on Jewish law in our day and age? Right? That seems to be the whole purpose of the rabbinate, to say, this guy is authorized to rule on Jewish law. But your average Rebbe in elementary school, who's called rabbi, he has no clue how to pass on Jewish law. He knows how to teach kids our faith, right? Yet he's called rabbi. So how do you know who actually is an authority to whom you can go? So the answer is you really don't. The only way you can find out is by reputation. In other words, people know and distinguish between rabbis who are just rabbis and rabbis who know how to issue halachic rulings and know how to pass it. They're called usually poskim. But that's not an official title. It's something which people, reputation, people get over time. Also, there are poskim who specialize in certain areas and are not necessarily acquainted with other areas of Jewish law. So therefore, you might go to them for something. Let's say you go to the person to ask a question on Eruv, but you wouldn't go to ask them a question which has to do with Kashrus, or vice versa. Right? So this is all by hearsay and reputation. None of it actually has to do with any specific authorization. Yeah.
So people who get the piece of paper rabbinic authority,
I see them intrigued by this.
Basically, does the United States government recognize that to the extent that they would change your name to have rabbi in the front of your name legally?
There is, in our day and age, there is no specific advantage that clergy has. Well, no, that's true, actually. Yes, they do. I take that back. But there is a specific advantage clergy has.
That's
parsonage, right? Mm-hmm. The main example, parsonage,
living house.
Parsonage is a tax deduction which rabbis get. Their living expenses, or any clergy gets it, not just rabbis, and their living expenses are tax deductible, meaning their mortgage, their utilities, they don't have to pay taxes on that stuff.
Tax deductible or tax free?
Tax free.
Really?
Tax free, yeah. So,
do you have any of these pieces of paper in your house to print out?
So people who teach in day school usually get parsonage. Right.
And they get rabbi attached to their name legally.
Right, so the state is never going to get involved in trying to determine who's really a rabbi and who's not. That's all sorts of separation of church and state issues.
But you
have to have a clerical position. You can't just call yourself rabbi and get parsonage. You have to have demonstrate that you are involved either in, a synagogue or school. Well, we find a piece of paper for you saying this person is a member of our staff, we're giving shiur once a week, so then you can get away with it.
Yeah, but you can't, it's only tax-free for the money you get for that shiur. If I taught a shiur once a week and I had a law practice,
yeah.
The money from the law practice wouldn't be tax-free. The money you spend on your apartment would be.
Yeah,
it's the money you spend on your house and your housing and all that sort of stuff.
I believe that is true. I believe that is correct. That you, even if the money comes in from your law salary, but you can still deduct the. I might be mistaken about that. It might only be from the job itself. I don't remember the parameters.
In some places, I think it has to do with the percentage of your employment. Mm. If you get a third from your prior finished stuff, then it's a third taken.
There also is another interesting quirk in the American tax system, which has to do with being a rabbi, which is when they legislated the Social Security system back in the 1930s, so they were allowed clergy who were opposed to public welfare to opt out of the system.
What?
it's fair and square. You opt out of the system, you get no Social Security. In other words, if you are a conscientious objector to Social Security, you can opt out only if you're a rabbi or
priest. You get more money like the Roth IRA than you can with Social Security.
What?
Like if you put the money that you would put in Social Security and you put it into an investment of some kind, like a mutual fund, probably make more money, but
yeah, unless there is like a stock market bubble.
Yeah, well, there's a stock market bubble.
The stock market bubble goes down to 7,000 in a few months.
Okay, but there's a rabbi, common rabbi, who told me about this guy way back when I was still learning yeshiva, and he said to me, you know, he doesn't know if he's going to be around long enough. Hashem should help him, but he doesn't know if he's going to be around long enough to collect Social Security. B, he doesn't know if Social Security system will still be, will still exist by the time he gets old enough to collect Social Security. So if he opted out of the system, and he pays no Social Security debts, then he will get no Social Security.
So you can still do that.
Yes.
Okay. Rabbi, don't you opt out of Social Security.
He wants you to pay for it.
It's a much better deal.
He just wants me to pay for it.
Okay, so those are advantages which in theory you can get if you are a rabbi, even in the United States of America. But you don't get off your phone bills or things like that. You don't get to park in special places. That's a misconception. You know,
no such reduction.
So therefore, as we said, there is no way. There's no way of knowing if a person is legitimately issuing halachic rulings or not. But I totally get to a lot of this today, but I think I still have to get to it more on Thursday. The question is, okay, in the absence of such authorization, so how is halacha decided nowadays in the main age? So can any Tom, Dick, and Harry, Tom, Dick, or Harry, step to the plate and say, I'm going to issue my opinion, or is there some sort of semblance of process or procedure by which this is done? So it's interesting. Back in the 80s, there was a movement to try and create a new title that rabbis would be rabbis, and they'd be called rabbi so and so, and people who really knew their stuff would be called rabbi so and so, like a higher level of respect. But it never got off the ground. So, but there was Rabbi Kamenetsky was spearheading such a thing at the time. Although, again, as I say, it never happened. Okay. So, a few things. Again, we'll start now and we'll finish on Wednesday. So, halacha is in our day and age. Let's say you have a question which you actually have to ascertain or decide on, halachically. What bracha to make on cornflakes, right? That's an internal question. What bracha to make on cornflakes? A very big machlokas going back for many years, whether you make a shahakol, a adama, or even according to perhaps a mazonos on cornflakes. This is one of the classic minor questions in Judaism, right? So let's say you want to issue a ruling on this. Rabbi Ron wants to come along and issue a ruling on a cornflake question,
shahakol.
So you can go, and if you have the right books, to look it up, so then you're allowed to issue a ruling, even if you're not a rabbi. There is nothing in our day and age, the Ramah writing, Shulchan Aruch says, that once upon a time people had real rebbes. And, they would go to their rebbe and learn Torah, and the rebbe would then, at some point say, okay, now you're old enough and mature enough to go issue a ruling. Nowadays, our rebbes are the sforim, are the books which contain halachic material. So therefore, the book is mute. It doesn't actually give you permission to issue rulings. But that's the idea. If you are able to go, if you're intelligent enough to look things up, and you know the right sources, then you can issue rulings regardless of whether you have that appellation rabbi or not.
What if it goes against the major posse?
Well, that's a good question. We'll speak about that. but interestingly enough, in this regard, when the Chafetz Chaim wrote the Mishnah Berurah, Mishnah Berurah is a basic tract of Jewish law. We all familiar with Mishnah Berurah.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have smicha. He had no smicha. He only got smicha for the first time when he was in his late 80s. And the only reason he got smicha, he had a telegram by Rav Chaim Moshe Grodzinski, who was about 30 years younger than he was. He was a rabbi in Vilna, because he needed a piece of paper in order to travel from Poland to Austria, I believe it was at the time. So therefore, he had to get an official smicha. But until that time, he had no real smicha. He was Mr. Kagan. But nevertheless, he was able to issue halachic ruling because he was looking into books, seeing what the book said, compiling them, and coming to conclusions. And usually the way he reads the way he reached conclusion, and we're going to speak about this a little bit more on Wednesday, usually the way the Bureau reached the conclusion is by drawing up a list of who says what, seeing which opinion predominates. In other words, who's got more people on their side, and say, there are more people on this side, this is the way we're going to rule. And that is an application of the principle of, which we're going to have to speak out in detail, Acharei Rabim Lahakos. The Torah says you follow the majority in the Sanhedrin, right? Yeah, what happened? How is Sanhedrin issue? We need to take a vote, right? So the majority rules, right? As long as we have a legitimately constituted court and they take a vote, the majority rules in the Sanhedrin. So therefore, throughout the ages, one of the tools which was used in order to determine Sakalacha is to count up, tabulate the amount of poskim, and say, there are more poskim, and this side, majority rules. It's not just his tradition. It goes back, ostensibly, to the author of the Shulchan Aruch. The author of the Shulchan Aruch, the Yitzchak Kalo, he has said, the way he is said to have put together the Shulchan Aruch, he said, look, there are three big Rishonim, the three big guns among the Rishonim, in terms of Halacha, are the Rif, the Rosh, and the Rosh and the Rambam, every issue he would see what these three people had to say, and he would issue his ruling according to the majority among those three. The Ramah, the Moshe Isselish, who wrote the Ashkenazic glasses of the Shulchan Aruch, was not happy with that, because he said, hey, they might not be, you know, the authorities like these three, but we've got other authorities too. Especially us Ashkenazim, you know, we've had these authorities through the ages. So he appended his glosses, which consist primarily of traditions which the Ashkenazic Rishonim, the authors of the Tosfos, their students, came up with, and he appended that to the Shulchan Aruch and said, this is Ashkenazic practice, and we have the right to rule accordingly. Actually, there's a commentary on Shulchan Aruch and there's a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah from the Vilna Gaon, which is the Ramah, the Vilna Gaon's commentary, is primarily intended to demonstrate that the laws which the Ramah brings down from Ashkenazic sources can be authenticated and traced back to the Gemara itself. In other words, don't think that they came up with this on their own, and you know, they're smaller fry than the Ramah, the Rif, and the Rosh. No. They can go back, and I'll show you that they actually have their sources in Gemaras, and therefore they have the right, the Ashkenazim have the right to follow these authorities, and do not necessarily have to follow the Rif, the Rosh, and the Rambam. Okay? So this is still, that was done already back in the 16th century, when the Shulchan Aruch was committed to writing. So certainly it should be, it's something which could be used nowadays. The question, however, is how do you tabulate, how do you make a roll? How do you make a majority? How many books do you look at, right? Like Shulchan Beis Yosef said, okay, I'm going to limit myself to three. And other books he used when there was no clarity in the major big three. But how does the Mishnah Berurah know who to include in his tally and who not to include in his tally? That's a very important question, right? We'll come back to that one.
You want these back, yeah?
Yeah. I hope that was informative.
Okay.
I issue Ravamani for the right price.